Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The Atlantic recently devoted an entire issue to the exploration of something most Americans have forgotten about, but which continues to reverberate in the country today: Reconstruction. The magazine traced the history of Reconstruction, the period following the end of the Civil War and of slavery. It examined how it came to be, what it was intended to accomplish, and what it did and did not deliver. How Black Americans kept Reconstruction alive long after it ended in 1877, and how Reconstruction created American public education. Bet you didn't know that. The magazine also poses an important question: why is America afraid of Black history? And it takes itself to task for a series of articles it published in 1901 that took a dim view of the era and of the idea that all Americans ought to participate in the democratic process, an idea that some continue to debate today. The Atlantic senior editor Van Newkirk brought together some of the nation's greatest thinkers and writers to grapple with the intense battles currently being waged over voting rights, access to education, and equal protection under the law, because all of those skirmishes in our current culture have roots in Reconstruction, which isn't history. It's unfinished history. Van Newkirk is with us for the hour. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Adam Harris, a staff writer for The Atlantic, who wrote the article on the connection between Reconstruction and the creation of American public education. And we'll delve deeply into that in a few minutes. Adam, thank you for joining us as well. Welcome.
Absolutely. Good to be with you.
So, Van, let me start with you. What led your magazine, The Atlantic, which has been going for a long time, to devote an entire issue to Reconstruction, and why now?
Well, as you said, we have been going for a long time, and a very important part of that history was our early commitment to abolition, and also our publication of essays from Frederick Douglass and others that were chronicling the history, the present then, of Reconstruction. So we consider Reconstruction an era that is a vital part of the magazine's story and history. As to why we want to revisit it today, as you said, it is our unfinished history or unfinished business. More directly, we are in a world right now with multiple crises, issues of political legitimacy, and a national picture where people appear to be more pessimistic than ever. And I believe that the story of Reconstruction, the story of these people who did things that before would have been considered absolutely impossible, I think that that story is of actually rebuilding, reconstructing the nation. That's one that we need today, not just in symbol, but we need to go back and look at the practical ways that people reimagine the world, that especially Black people reimagine the world. And I think those things have a lot to teach us about what we can do today.
I don't want to get too sidetracked here, but you mentioned that your magazine was an early supporter of abolition, led the way in many ways back in the 19th century. And yet in 1901, and you go into this in the magazine, you kind of took a different view of Reconstruction and whether or not people should fully participate. How do you explain that shift and what is now, I guess, a tilt back in the opposite direction?
Well, it is important for us to always acknowledge that we don't always get it right. And that 1901 issue was a product of a time and an intellectual movement that sought to minimize the role of Reconstruction in America and play up the idea that it was a mistake. So it was, that series was a debate ostensibly between people who liked Reconstruction and people who didn't. It leaned pretty heavily in the side of those who didn't, and the official editorial decision there was to say that the project of giving the freedmen the vote had been a mistake and a disaster. It featured such luminaries as Woodrow Wilson, who later, as president, showed the film The Birth of a Nation and praised it. It also featured the historians who created the Dunning School, which sought to say that Reconstruction was a mistake because harmony between the races was a mistake. But to our credit, on the plus side, we featured an article, an essay from a younger W.E.B. Du Bois, who argued that giving Black people the vote was the least that America could do. And I think it's important for us to highlight that because, one, it is important for us to own up to where we have made mistakes and where we have been wrong, and to reckon with our place in making elite opinion in the country, but also to look at people like Du Bois, who, against the tide of time, who against our own masthead, told the truth. And I think that's something that we can really take from today.
Adam, I want to bring you into this conversation at this point because you are the person who wrote the article on public education. And although this is not necessarily in your article, I'm sure you did enough reading and researching to write this to know the answer to this question. Because a lot of people, although I think most NPR listeners know what we're talking about when we talk about Reconstruction, there may be some who are not quite clear on what it was, what its function was, why it came about, when it was. So can you give us a little thumbnail of what it was?
Reconstruction is effectively the period after the Civil War. That varies in terms of, depending on which state you were in, it may have lasted a little bit longer, it may have lasted a little bit shorter, but somewhere between, 10 to 12 years into about 1877, where there was a sort of project to reimagine what a system of government, an American society that actually wrapped all of its people into the structure of citizenship, in a sort of more equal way, right? You had these pushes in education and healthcare, to sort of grant these rights of citizenship to folk, right? This is when you get the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment, right? There are all of these really, really interesting pushes. I think one of the things that didn't go into the article that I think is an interesting examination and a way to think about this is, I think about 1871 a lot because in Mississippi, in particular, in 1871, you had a Reconstruction legislature that was trying some really neat things around higher education, right? They created Alcorn State University, gave it a $50,000 appropriation for at least a decade, right? And as you move towards those last couple of years of Reconstruction, you can see how the tide began to change. So in 1875, they reduced that appropriation to $15,000 a year as the so-called redeemers come in. A year later, they reduce that appropriation again to $5,500 a year. Meanwhile, as I write in the piece, right, the University of Mississippi was actively saying we would rather, the faculty said we'd rather resign and this institution close than to educate Black students. And so you start to see that dichotomy resurfacing after that period of Reconstruction begins to come to an end.
And I think it should be mentioned that the people of that time in America were trying to accomplish something pretty daunting, and that was not only the rebuilding of the country following the Civil War, but the reintegration of the South into the country, both its white citizens and its newly freed Black citizens, and debating the questions of exactly how Black citizens would be citizens and operate in that world. And it was a daunting task about which they made many mistakes, as anybody probably would at that time. But those mistakes evidently continue. And several constitutional amendments arose as a result of Reconstruction, among them the 14th Amendment, which is relevant today because the Supreme Court just recently made an interpretation surrounding the 14th Amendment. And there may be another about whether a president who was allegedly involved in an insurrection is allowed to serve, because there's a clause in the 14th Amendment that evidently, depending upon how you interpret it, says you can't. Talk about that, Van, and why we are still debating of the 14th Amendment from the 1860s.
I think it's safe to say and accurate to say that we currently live in the 14th Amendment's world. A lot of the tension that it went into and created the Civil War was over whether this is a true democracy in which everyone is equally protected under law. And the 14th Amendment, in enshrining that into our Constitution, sets a tension actually with a lot of the other portions of the Constitution. So, especially in the last 50 years, since the Voting Rights Act and the other legislation of the Civil Rights Movement essentially affirmed the 14th Amendment's proactive protection of minorities in this country, the Supreme Court, our legislature, and our presidency have all been essentially at war over, at political war over the ramifications of the 14th Amendment. So the Supreme Court, as you mentioned, decisions on voting rights, decisions on abortion, decisions on what happens to people who are engaged in insurrection, and things coming down the pipeline on the environment, on climate. And also, we've got one that was decided that Adam is really interested in, which is affirmative action. So, pretty much the entire docket now of cases to watch, of things that are reshaping this country again, it's this live, open interpretation of the 14th Amendment.
Adam, a lot of your article about education and the establishment of public education talks about progress being made and then the backlash that resulted as a result of that, which we're going to talk about. But when it comes to a lot of the issues surrounding the 14th Amendment, is what we're witnessing a long, slow backlash to something that happened 150 years ago?
Yeah, I think what we know from history, right? You get Reconstruction, you get the Redeemers, right? You get the Nadir, you get the Civil Rights Movement, and then you get this like pretty vehement pushback to the advancements that were made during the Civil Rights Movement. And so I think that this what we're seeing now is not only, in response to the 14th Amendment, but it's also in response to the Civil Rights Acts. It's in response to the Voting Rights Act, right? All of these advancements that have been made in order to build out, this idea that we all live with, right? The idea to make this a more perfect union. We are seeing some of the fruits of the backlash to that in this moment.
And although our founding documents talk about more perfect union, or maybe it was Lincoln, I can't remember who said who made that allusion, but perhaps there are some of us who don't want a more perfect union. We don't want to be unified. It just seems to me that we keep fighting the same battles over and over again. Your magazine, Van, The Atlantic, first published an article about Reconstruction in 1866, written by Frederick Douglass, and you call it the most important article that the Atlantic published in the immediate post-war era. In that article, Frederick Douglass called for a radical reimagining of the American idea that even then was the recipient of building opposition, which by 178, excuse me, by 1877, would, you wrote, prove shattering to the cause of equality. So, Reconstruction was this radical attempt to reform American society and how we shape our nation. I only have 30 seconds. Was it doomed to fail from the start?
I don't think it was doomed to fail from the start. I think if you look at from where they stood, there was a real likelihood, a real chance that this experiment was going to actually get the runway it needed and survive. So I think it was possible. It didn't happen, obviously, but it could have.
And we'll talk a little bit more of that. I threw you a curve by asking you an impossible question in 30 seconds. We'll come back to that in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the December issue of The Atlantic to reconstruct the nation. The entire issue is devoted to Reconstruction and brings out a lot of things that you may or may not have known about that period in our history, part of which we are still feeling today because we're still fighting some of the same battles. Van Newkirk is the senior editor of The Atlantic, and Adam Harris is a staff writer who contributed mightily to a section on the establishment of public education in America that stemmed from that time period. I just asked you, threw you a curveball, Van, about was Reconstruction doomed to fail from the start? It certainly didn't fail for many African Americans of that time period because they did take many steps forward only to have those, have that progress reversed. And that seems to be a pattern that we experience in American life. Overall, was it a boon for African Americans?
I think if you look at the things, the institutions, the ways of life, the ways of being that were maintained after the official end of Reconstruction, you look at the Black churches that still stand, you look at the historically Black colleges and universities that still stand, the Black communities that still stand, it's a lot more complicated than to say that this was a promising era and then a failure. Because in many ways, it never really ended. You had a people who were making, for the first time, making a free life, figuring out what it meant to be free. And that process did not end in 1877. That process continues today. So I think that it wasn't totally, obviously, a wash. I think the era was carried on and continued by Black communities themselves. Federal involvement in that era and protection under law in that experiment obviously were done away with in 1877.
But it wasn't just about Black people. Reconstruction was also about white people and about learning to live together and about bringing white Southerners who just a minute and a half before Reconstruction began were rebelling against the United States and rejecting a lot of what the United States espoused. And how do you bring those people back in? How do, and I hate to use the word re-educate, but how do you reinstill in them values that they disagreed with vehemently and fought against and died for? How do you bring them back in? And I'm wondering from that point of view, were we successful or were we a failure, given evidence in the current climate that some of the same opinions, some of the same battles are being waged yet again?
Well, I think this speaks to, I know you don't like the phrase re-education, but it does speak to education, because I think the story of the redeeming era, the redemption era, and what happened after shows that getting those especially working class white folks on board with this project, it requires a bit of work. It's not something that people are born with passively. You saw in the immediate aftermath of Reconstruction, there were still around the South what were called fusion governments, where Black folks and white farmers, white laborers actually worked together to create governments. And it, for the very, at least the sake of political expediency, worked together. You saw repeatedly over the South movements of white labor and Black labor that were aligned, even if briefly. And what happens is that solidarity, it is something that I think threatens the, at least in the South, the architects of Jim Crow. And so today, and throughout history, you see the ongoing project of trying to erase that history, of trying to erase those stories of people acting together, of trying to indoctrinate people in the idea that Black folks are inherently inferior and not to be sympathized with.
Adam, it's part of the problem here. How we teach and the amount we teach about Reconstruction in our schools today and in years gone by. I don't know how much time we the teachers are allowed or have time to spend on Reconstruction, but if we spent more time on it, if we examined the issues that they were grappling with then and compared them to what we are still grappling with today, would we have less of a problem today, but we have a better understanding today.
I think an accurate teaching and a sort of more robust understanding of what the Reconstruction Project was seeking to accomplish would, you know, equip people with a better understanding of why people so vehemently opposed it, right? You know, to your question about, you know, things like education and the sort of need for education, you know, it was kind of known at the time, right? You saw several Northern editorials, you saw, you know, Black folks in the South effectively saying, it's not just about educating, you know, public schools isn't just about educating Black students. It's about educating, you know, poor white Southerners. It's about educating the broader population here. If you go back to the founding of the nation, right, the founders thought that education was perhaps the most important thing that Congress could fund. George Washington, in his first address to Congress, says that, you know, there's nothing that better deserves your patronage than higher education. By the time he gets to his final address to Congress, he is again saying there, you know, he couldn't stop thinking about colleges in particular, right? Places that they could sort of bring people into a national character, understand the values of citizenship, even if he wasn't necessarily applying that citizenship to everybody in a more, you know, broad sense. I think if you apply that logic to what that Reconstruction Project was trying to accomplish, to say that education is a vital piece of being a citizen, of being a good citizen. And if we wrap everybody within that blanket of broader education, then perhaps we can move towards a you know, more engaged citizenry, a more, you know, accommodating citizen.
And I want to talk a little bit later on about the forces that were in favor of and those opposed to public education and just the whole idea of educating the citizenry at large, because there were those who recognized the value even then and those who fought against it. You've said, Van, that this period of Reconstruction has been warped repeatedly over time. And therefore, I guess it would follow that our understanding of it has also been warped as well. Was that deliberate? And if so, who or what were the forces behind it?
Oh, of course it was deliberate. You see the forces, I think actually during Reconstruction, the project of redeeming the South from Black tyranny or Negro rule, it relied on casting Reconstruction as a project of Northern dominion, by which they gave their Black cronies who weren't deserving of votes, of being in politics, they gave them the keys, right? So from the very start, I think, this story of Reconstruction as a illegitimate and really incompetent experiment in giving these people rule. That starts from day one.
And this is not an isolated example of what we're talking about here. And there are forces at work that still feel exactly that way, that anything that promotes that side of the equation is illegitimate. Is that something is that something we can overcome? I mean, that seems to be baked into the genes.
Well, I was excited to talk with y'all because I was born in Charlotte and raised in North Carolina. And when I was a kid, textbooks around the state still basically used the old Lost Cause version of history, which was that Reconstruction was a failure, if they mentioned Reconstruction at all. And so I think in the present, this is one of the things that we are excited about with this magazine, is there's a whole lot of work to do with educating, with telling the real story of Reconstruction, and with understanding the ramifications of that real story.
And you point out something that it never occurred to me that this is still playing a role, but you've said that for most Americans, their entry point into that period of our history is D.W. Griffith's The Birth of a Nation. It's a silent film that came from the earliest days of movie making, and it comes at the audience from a white supremacist point of view. I tried to watch The Birth of a Nation and was unable to get past the first 30 or 40 minutes because it's just through contemporary eyes, unwatchable. And then when you layer in the white supremacist nonsense that's in there, it just becomes gut-wrenchingly unwatchable. So how does a silent movie that most people have never seen a frame of still influence us today?
Well, I think it says a lot that that was actually our first blockbuster. The first American film blockbuster was The Birth of a Nation. It essentially catapulted what was then a very fledgling form in film into the public eye. And so I think while most people today haven't seen it, there was a time when the only movie that most Americans had seen was The Birth of a Nation. So when you look at if those people are the ones who and that's what they're absorbing, and they're the ones who are writing the textbooks, and the movie is endorsed by the sitting president of the United States, and they go on tour, and people who have likely never really engaged with Black history before, this is what they engage with. They're going to be teaching their children that obviously this thing Reconstruction was a bad idea, and these Black folks were not worthy of getting the vote and getting into politics. So this was, it wasn't just a, you know, I think a pop culture moment. It was you see repeatedly, the history of America especially is filtered through our cultural products. And this was up until maybe, I think the most widely watched film about Reconstruction after The Birth of a Nation was Wild Wild West featuring Will Smith. So until Will Smith fought a mechanical spider on screen, if you wanted to watch anything or see anything about Reconstruction, it was The Birth of a Nation.
although, as you said, our textbooks and the way it's taught in school is influenced by the pop culture as well. Let's talk a little bit how it came about. If there was such a push against it, it only came about because following the Civil War, the South was fairly unrepresented. Those points of view were unrepresented in the national legislature because they were forbidden from serving for a long period of time. So a lot of the amendments that passed, the idea of Reconstruction, some of the things that Reconstruction tried to achieve, happened only because those members were expelled from Congress and they were freed to pass these laws. But a lot of this also happened in New Orleans, interestingly enough, because it fell to the North early in the Civil War. So take us through that, Adam, because this is the beginnings of public education, so to speak. And New Orleans, ironically, plays a role in this, a key role.
Yeah. New Orleans, you know, was one of the first major cities in the South to fall to Union troops. And what they were able to do there was sort of set up a government, you know, the Department of the Gulf. And effectively, that department set about to the work of helping to organize schools, right? They set up a school board. They, you know, set up sort of their own form of local government, and they took to the work of educating people, of providing people with healthcare. There were several general orders that were put out that said, you know, if people needed fuel, if people needed housing, they could sort of go there, and it became a form of welfare state in order to help reintegrate people into citizenship or bring people into citizenship to begin with. And so that sort of model that was created in New Orleans, established in New Orleans, you know, as the war progressed, you get into 1864, you have, you know, folks like Charlotte Fortin out in South Carolina, who writes this beautiful piece about how her life on the islands around Hilton Head, and how she was, you know, teaching Black students down there in 1864, and ultimately gets published in The Atlantic. You have, so sort of these missionary associations that are coming into areas and starting to educate populations, but then the federal government and the Freedmen's Bureau is sort of created, and they ultimately get involved and say, okay, listen, we are going to help these smaller, missionary association funded groups to be better organized. We're going to form a system of education that we're sort of directing from the top. And we talked about some of the animosity that Southerners had towards, Southern whites had towards The idea of Reconstruction, head towards the ideas of the Freedmen's Bureau, in part because they thought it was a top-down approach. The government's coming in, they're telling us what to do. We didn't have a say in it because, we wouldn't have any representatives in Congress at the time. And you sort of start to see that animosity coming back up as some of these programs go into effect. I write in the piece about Mary Brice, who came down from Ohio as as someone who just wanted to do good. She wanted to help educate Black students who were without education in New Orleans. And she was routinely run out of her schoolhouses for her work. She was routinely threatened because of her work. Some of the teachers, like Mary Brice, were threatened and killed for the work that they were trying to do in educating Black students and sort of and educating poor whites because of the sort of liberalizing influence that education could have.
You mentioned the Freedmen's Bureau, and I'm not sure many people know about the Freedmen's Bureau. A lot of you write in your article that much of the early progress toward establishing public schools that served everyone was diminished when the Freedmen's Bureau was dissolved by Congress in 1872. That's also when you say, quote, "A large share of the federal government's oversight of common schools disappeared. Over the next decades, the educational foundation built by the Freedmen's Bureau endured a concerted assault from white supremacists." Again, that seems to be a recurring theme in American history. Racial progress deemed to need federal protections. Those protections are removed. We regress. And there are parallels to this recent Supreme Court decision that certain voting protections are no longer required or necessary. What can we learn about what may happen as a result of looking at what did happen after Reconstruction?
I often think about the sort of umbrella analogy, right? Where you can say, oh, it's I have an umbrella and so I'm not getting rained on, but it's raining all around you. And if you take away that umbrella, you're going to get rained on. That is effectively what has happened consistently, right? You put in those federal protections, they serve as an umbrella. You have, the strength of the 14th Amendment and the Equal Protection Clause. You have, the strength of the Voting Rights Act. You have the strength of the Civil Rights Act. And once those umbrellas are removed, you have you're exposed to the external influences.
Adam Harris is a staff writer for The Atlantic, which we're talking about their Reconstruction issue. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Van Newkirk is with us. He's senior editor of The Atlantic. Their December 23 issue is to reconstruct the nation. It's devoted entirely to the Reconstruction era and the reverberations of that era to the present time. Adam Harris wrote the article, The Black Roots of American Education, in that issue, which we'll talk a little bit more about as well. Van, as you mentioned a second ago, you are from North Carolina, which is home to the oldest public university in America, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And during Reconstruction, Black students, I believe, were first admitted until 1871, when state legislators stripped the school of funding and forced it to close. When it reopened in 1875, Adam reports, quote, "Several avowed white supremacists sat on its new board of trustees, including one former leader of the state Ku Klux Klan." Now, we can't equate today's Republican legislature with those who decided in 1871 to close UNC, or the white supremacists who were appointed to be on the board in 1875 by those former legislators who sat on the board. But we do have conservatives today in the state working to have a greater influence on what is taught, how it is taught, and who teaches it at UNC. Those moves aren't necessarily based entirely on race, but it certainly enters into the equation. So is this another example of backsliding from Reconstruction?
I should also note that I am a UNC alum, so this is it's a fun subject for me, and I've been covering I think the push and pull of politics in the state for years. I mean, ultimately, where the rubber meets the road here is if I came back home and put my children in school in Nash County, where I went to high school, they may not be able to read the stuff that I write. That is where we are as a state and as a region in the South. So I don't even know if I would call that necessarily backsliding. It's we're entering a new time. There wasn't an era where you would have had these things as explicitly barred and had this level of sort of activist intervention, especially for Black students. So I think in many ways, I would say this is analogous to and part of this recurring white backlash, but I think there are some innovations here.
Adam, in your article about the Black contributions to American public education and essentially it being the progenitor of American public education, you talk about how there were forces in favor of promoting education at the lower levels and higher education for everybody, and the recognition of the need that if we're going to be a successful nation, we have to have educated citizens. And then there were those opposed to it. There are people today who don't see the need to help pay for college educations, etc. And yet, the need for an educated workforce has never been greater than it is today. And you spend, as I said, a lot of time writing about Louisiana when discussing public education, because evidently they did a particularly good job of circumventing the strides made during Reconstruction and of circumventing federal mandates regarding the quality of education throughout much of the 20th century, particularly for Black students. But you point out that, quote, even after court-mandated desegregation, educational opportunity has been highly stratified by race, and both educational attainment and quality in America as a whole have lagged relative to other wealthy countries. Okay, so we know we need to have an educated workforce. Are we shooting ourselves in the foot here repeatedly, over and over again?
I really think so. And it stems from a couple of things, right? As I mentioned a little bit earlier, right, the founders had this idea of a national university, of sort of broader push for education. You move towards the 1810s to 1815, where you have folks who are like, you're reaching another war period. And they're like, well, we need a military mind, but we also need a higher education. We need citizens to actually care about the values of the nation. You move towards the 1860, there's another push for education. In New Orleans, you have this large push for education. But then as that starts to be rolled back, it's always in a sort of selfish vein, right? In the 1870s, 1880s, and 1890s, you have a white supremacist push to remove those educational rights for Black citizens in Louisiana. But now, there is this idea that it, particularly, for higher education, we'll talk about K-12 in just a second, but on a higher education, there's this idea that it's a private good, that it only affects the person who gets that degree. You get a degree, you get a job, that's great for you. As opposed to with a more educated population, you have people, more engaged in more engaged in government. People who have college degrees are more likely to vote, right? Little things like that. Which also probably explains why people push back so forcefully against people having educations, people going to college, because there's this, you see it constantly with, conservative legislatures at this point trying to push conservative members of the Board of Trustees, right? You've seen it in Ohio, you've seen it in Florida, you've seen it in North Carolina, where you have these ideologically centric boards who are making curricular demands that were not necessarily allowed in the past, right? Under the AAUP rules in 1914 and shared governance and things of the sort. But you've seen that pushback in education in particular because of the role that it plays in getting people more engaged and having people more knowledgeable about what's going on around.
Outside of your work for The Atlantic in this article that we've been talking about, you're the author of a book called The State Must Provide: Why America's Colleges Have Always Been Unequal and How to Set Them Right. And many of what we think of today as HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities, grew out of Reconstruction. But once that short period ended and Northern liberals became kind of tired of having to deal with the legacy of slavery, the investment in those schools declined and maybe in some cases effectively ended. Do you think that most people see the troubles faced by many HBCUs today as a vestige of the failure of Reconstruction, or is it completely disconnected from that?
I would say that if people don't see it as a vestige of Reconstruction, then they absolutely should. I often think about Kentucky, where, you have Kentucky State University is the public 1890, so Second Morrill Act HBCU in the state. And, there was a report in the 1940s from the Truman Commission that said that of all of the states in the nation, Kentucky funded black education and white education the most unequally at a rate of 42 to 1. This is after several years of little nickel and diming the institution, saying that they're going to send black students out of state for graduate school, and then taking $5,000 from Kentucky State's budget, but only spending $200 to send black students out of the state. Different things like that. But you move into today, and you had a legislator just a couple of years ago saying, oh, because Kentucky State doesn't know how to manage its funds, perhaps this institution should close or be merged with another institution. Well, the state has literally been underfunding the institution for years. In North Carolina, it's the same thing. In the 80s, late 70s, there was a report where, they looked at the high-tech pressure cookers that they used to sterilize laboratory equipment at North Carolina A&T and North Carolina Central. And then they looked at the same things at North Carolina State. And, there were something like 40 of these autoclaves at North Carolina State. And between North Carolina A&T and Central, they had three. And he was like, that's just one example of the broad difference and the vestiges of segregation and inequality that the institutions have faced.
On the other hand, there's music, because there's no getting away or denying the influence and the impact of African Americans on American music. Aside from editing this issue of The Atlantic, Van, you wrote the article in this issue entitled How the Negro Spiritual Changed American Popular Music and America Itself. The influence of African Americans on music is undeniable. Most people would date it to the early 20th century, to ragtime, to jazz or blues or R&B, or Motown, hip-hop, rap, etc. But it goes back much further than that. And you say it began in 1871 when the Fisk University Jubilee Singers went on a tour around the country. Talk about that.
Yeah, it seems we keep coming back to this year, 1871. It's important. So in this time, this was, again, just a few years after slavery. And so as Adam noted, a lot of these HBCUs were founded in this time. Fisk University was one of them. It was founded with the aid of missionary associations in Nashville, Tennessee. And like many of these universities, it was in many universities around the country generally, it was one with a spiritual mission. So it had a choir. And the director of that choir, George L. White, he was instructing, he was a former Freedmen's Bureau agent who was instructing these students, many of whom had been born into slavery. And he had this notion that they would drill so often and so rigorously and perform these folk songs, these European standards, all these songs that would show audiences that they were the equals of their white contemporaries. In 1871, Fisk, though, wasn't doing very well financially. They had a real big budget shortfall. George L. White also was the treasurer of the school. And he decided that they would send this group, this choir, out on the road to show, to impress these white audiences with their ability to hang with and be equals to their white contemporaries. They go on the road. They begin in the Midwest and the North, singing, essentially, doing just that. They don't draw a whole lot of crowds. They are usually barely able to, if they can, cover the expenses of their venues. They've got to raise something like $20,000, which in today's money is a lot of money, in order to keep the school alive. And it's not going so hot. But as part of their repertoire, they are singing Negro spirituals. They are a very small part of the repertoire. The songs were initially considered to be sacred or secret, things that were not supposed to be performed in front of white audiences. But as they go on, they begin to more and more make the spirituals the center of what they do. And in doing so, end up breaking through. They become an international phenomenon. Within that year, they are singing in the courts of the Kaiser of newly unified Germany and of Queen Victoria in the United Kingdom. So their decision actually to make the spirituals the center of their identity is one that goes well beyond proving they are the equals to their white contemporaries. They prove that they're something new and something valuable. And in the process, they help create what we know as popular music in America.
Of course, these Negro spirituals were a product of the period of enslavement, and in fact, white people at large had never heard them, but the overseers and the masters on the plantation heard them because these folks sang these songs, as you say, in the full view of the overseer's watchful eyes. But these were subversive. These lyrics were subversive. There were messages that the singers understood and that the black listeners understood. You call it the poison in the master's tea. So is the eventual flooding of black influence into American music also an example of a way to inculcate yourself into the culture kind of subversively and then capture it because people like it?
I argue that it is. And I think that's the nature of, again, popular music in America. Even before the Jubilee Singers got on the road, even before anybody ever heard a Negro spiritual, the closest thing to a nationally listened to music form was minstrelsy, was white people imitating what they believed or what they caricatured black folks' culture as. So black culture has always been a method of controlling discourse, of being able to influence the outcomes in this country. And so these spirituals early on, they were how people who were enslaved passed on secret messages. When you heard story, when you heard songs about going away to freedom land or about heaven or about the promised land, those, yes, they were spiritual songs about going to meet God in heaven, but also they were songs about going north. A lot of songs that help people keep time also could relay instructions about where the slaves would meet secretly after the field work was done. So I think this is kind of the DNA of the thing. It's always been an effort, an active effort to be able to express oneself, even in the eye of the oppressor, truly and fully.
We only have about 90 seconds left, but I want to bring up something that is rather extraordinary in today's magazine culture, and that is the fact that you, in this issue, you have printed an entire play by African American actress, playwright, author, and Professor Anna Deavere Smith. The play is called "The Ghost, This Ghost of Slavery: A Play of Past and Present." Did she write this specifically for this issue of the Atlantic?
She wrote this for The Atlantic, and when she came to us with it, it was essentially a moment of amazing serendipity. We were already working on Reconstruction. We've worked with Anna before on a Black History series called Inheritance, and she came to us and said she had this play that had come out of those conversations around Black history, and it's absolutely incredible. Number one, when Anna Deavere Smith comes to you with a play, you run it. You figure out a way to run it. But it's a remarkable play that focuses on Maryland and shows how, since it was a border state, its slavery, the status of slavery, was never truly resolved. And so she traces the current plight of Black youth in Baltimore to this history of the unresolved nature of slavery. I think it's a one-of-a-kind piece, and it was our honor to run it.
It's something she knows a lot about, but obviously for many reasons, not the least of which is the fact that she grew up in Baltimore. We've been talking about the Atlantic's December 2023 issue to reconstruct the nation, fascinating in many different aspects. Van Newkirk is the senior editor for the magazine, and Adam Harris is the staff writer who contributed the article on Black influence in American public education. Thank you both for the hour.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.